Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Dialogue Out Loud series. I'm Taylor Petrie, editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Today, we're excited to have with us Margaret Olson Hemming and H.B. Francino Olson. Margaret is a master student at Duke Divinity School and co-author of the groundbreaking The Book of Mormon for the Least of These Commentary. And H.B. is a faculty fellow at Ohio State University, focusing on gender-based violence, violence against children, and maternal and child health outcomes for marginalized populations. In their recent article, They Have Received Many Wounds, Applying a Trauma-Informed Lens to the Book of Mormon, they suggest a new way to read the Book of Mormon, and I'm really excited to talk to them about it. Margaret and HB, welcome. It's so nice to talk to you.
Thank you, Taylor. Thanks so much.
So let's start with the basics. How do you know one another, and what got you interested in writing about the Book of Mormon together?
Do you want to start, Margaret?
Sure. Yeah. So HB was actually, we were in the same ward here in Chapel Hill. So she was pursuing a PhD in public health and attending UNC. And I have been living here for many years. She graduated and moved on, but we have stayed friends. Frequently communicate on Marco Polo, actually. And a few years ago, I believe it was right after we had a lesson on Abraham and Isaac in gospel doctrine, she and I were sharing messages back and forth. And she was at the time doing research on inherited trauma. She can tell you more about that, but trauma that's been passed down generationally in South Africa. And I, at the time, had a two young children who were foster placements in my home. And after that class, which of course we had separately, but the same week, we shared how day-to-day work with survivors of trauma, particularly children who have experienced trauma at the hands of an adult, particularly a parent, prompts you to read that story a little differently and to experience it differently when you're in a class of adults talking about how God tells a father to kill his child. And I was experiencing trying to we brought these children to church with us. They were in primary. They heard this story. And I was trying to deal with their struggle with how to understand this story as children who had, already been through a significant amount of trauma with their parents. So this was sort of born out of that idea of like, what is biblical studies doing with that story? What is biblical studies doing with topics of trauma in general? And once we started diving into that research, there's quite a bit out there in biblical studies. And then we said, well, maybe it should be out there for the Book of Mormon as well.
HB, anything to add?
I think the only thing I would add is Margaret said that all perfectly. I think she and I have both sat in a lot of lessons like this. I don't think the Abraham and Isaac lesson is the only one where we've experienced people talking about these really traumatic and inherently violent events. And I don't do a very good job compartmentalizing my work life from my personal life. It all kind of spills together. So when I'm spending all day, either dealing with data or hearing the very personal stories of kids who are affected by violence and the traumatic events, I don't do a good job being able to set that aside. I think Margaret as well, being able to set that aside and then go to these lessons where we hear people be really dismissive of traumatic or violent events happening in the scriptures or really seek to rationalize that. When I'm working in a community and we're hearing from adults that it's okay that they behave this way towards children because of XYZ, I see a very clear like line between that kind of thinking and the kind of thinking we bring to our gospel studies. So for me, I think, I won't speak for Margaret, but for me, this article is very personal in that respect, because I think if we can shift the way we are approaching our religious studies and reading the Book of Mormon, I would be hopeful that we can shift the way we approach vulnerable children or vulnerable populations and bring that same care and empathy to them as well.
Well, you can tell that this article kind of came out of the long conversation that both of you have been having, as well as the deep care that you have for the text and for the readers of the text as well. And so I'm really excited for people to read this and wrestle with some of the great ideas. So let's dive in a little bit more. You're suggesting that a trauma-informed hermeneutic or interpretive lens is a way that we can start to read the Book of Mormon. Before we get into any specifics here, can you define trauma a little bit more? It is a term that kind of just comes up in pop culture, but I think you're trying to apply a little bit more rigorous meaning to it here too.
HB, you want to go ahead?
I will give it a try. I'm not a clinician, but my work does inherently deal with trauma in talking about violence. So trauma, the word trauma inherently means wound. That's what it's speaking to. And I think we're very comfortable with thinking about trauma as like physical traumas. A gunshot wound is a physical trauma that the body would suffer. And so when we're applying it to the text, we're thinking, and we explicitly say it in the article, we are approaching it thinking about psychological trauma. So what are the harms and the wounds that individuals or families or entire cultures carry from harmful events, and how does that shape behavior and action is the approach that we brought to the article.
So you mentioned, I think, Margaret, you're the first one to mention this, that this trauma-informed hermeneutic is actually something that comes out of biblical studies as a kind of parallel to your work. What is a kind of trauma-informed reading of the text, or a hermeneutic is a sort of fancy word here, but what is that, and how does it show up in biblical studies as a kind of prelude to that informs what you ultimately will do with the Book of Mormon? But what does it look like in those fields?
Yeah, it was interesting for me personally to kind of go into this with the question, well, is there anything out there in biblical studies? And then start reading and discover, oh, wow, there's a lot out there in biblical studies. And we spent a lot of time going through how, sociologists, refugee studies, psychologists, theologians, all of these groups have approached it differently. I would say the text of the Bible is inherently different from the Book of Mormon in how it approaches trauma. There's a great deal around Jeremiah, other books that center around the exile, that is clearly poetry that is struggling to make sense of the exilic wound of trauma. And so much, particularly of the Old Testament, is sort of circling around this one particular event. And they're struggling with issues of theodicy. They're struggling with issues of where is God now? Does God still exist? Who is at fault for this catastrophe? In the Book of Mormon, there isn't a singular event that you can say this is traumatic for this people. Instead, it's a book that is a series of probably smaller events, and you can't pinpoint exactly, okay, this is the trauma that they're wrestling with. Instead, it's, okay, what do we see in the after effects of this battle? And what happens when, this natural disaster, destroys this city? But you see a lot of the same questions. Where is God? Does does God still exist? Do we still have this relationship with God? Who are we as a people? Does our faith, should our faith as a community still exist? You see, I'm struggling with many of the same issues.
So it sounds like one of the things that trauma studies is doing is inviting us not only to look at the traumatic events that the peoples of the Bible are dealing with, but also to better understand them by looking at the sociological, psychological, cultural studies of contemporary populations that have experienced trauma as well, to kind of help us to better make sense of what's going on in the biblical text. Is that an accurate representation?
Yeah, I would say so. Hold on, I'm going to pause this to get my dog away.
Okay.
While Margaret does that, I'll give her more credit than she's giving herself. She said, we looked at a lot of like biblical study stuff. She read all of those. So that was very much the scriptorian Margaret really digging into it. So yeah, she did a ton of work to really try to understand where the biblical studies field is on this.
Sorry, I assume we can edit that out, right?
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. No problem. Go ahead. And we'll keep what HB said in there too while you were stepping away. It's great.
Oh, sorry. She probably said something brilliant.
Yeah, I did. I was complimenting you. So.
Okay, so you're asking about not only how the people are processing it in the ancient record, but also how people are processing the text today. Is that right?
In part, the text today, but also to understand, not even readers of the text, but just to better understand how populations, how individuals respond to trauma in order for us to see parallels in the text as well, right? So if we understand the psychological responses that people have to trauma, we can deduce those from the scriptural text as they were experiencing this, right?
Yeah. So one good example that we talk a little bit about in the article and that biblical studies has really focused on is the question of why does the exile happen? Why is Israel conquered? And how the text ends up answering that question is it's because we weren't faithful enough. So that raises a lot of interesting questions. Does God empower Babylon to conquer Israel? Does God let Babylon conquer Israel? Does God want Babylon to conquer Israel as kind of a punishment to the people? There's a lot of interesting questions that come from that. If you're looking at it from a trauma-informed lens, it's a slightly different set of questions. You're looking more at why would that be the answer for the people? Is that what God wants? Did God want all these people to die and be removed from their homes? What is the psychological response for a people if they have been conquered and their entire world has gone into chaos? How do you reorganize that chaos? How do you make it make sense again? And the easiest way to make it make sense again is to say, God wasn't conquered. This is what God wanted. For readers with trauma today, we see a lot of the same patterns of behavior of trying to reorganize the world in a way that feels non-chaotic. So on a personal level, I see children all the time saying, well, it's my fault that my father hit me. It's my fault that this terrible thing happened to me, because it's too scary to say that the world is that chaotic, that bad things just simply happen to people and that God may not be in charge of it. So yeah, I think we see the same response on both macro and micro levels.
Yeah. And building on that, you see people working through trauma today in a way where they're talking about acceptance, but it's more resignation. Like, this couldn't have been stopped or this couldn't have been avoided. I think those same themes come up in what Margaret is talking about, that what gets contextualized or spoken about as acceptance or even sometimes healing from a traumatic event is more, it's more just kind of needing to feel like there was no possible way for this event to be avoided in order to avoid the cognitive strain of the harder thing to think about, as she said, that the world is chaotic or that the sometimes bad things just happen and we can't stop them.
Right. There's a way of maybe reclaiming some agency in it all, too, right? So
yeah.
Given that the exile from Jerusalem to Babylon is such a central element of biblical studies, it seems actually weird that scholars have not made a bigger connection to the Book of Mormon, which begins with the Babylonian exile, the story there. And that sort of is where you start as well with Nephi. So that's the first example that you give. Can you talk to us a little bit about what a trauma-informed reading of Nephi's story brings that we hadn't seen before?
We'll start there and Margaret can chime in. I will say that writing this article was perhaps the closest that I ever felt to Nephi, because I finally felt like I could connect with him as an individual, rather than as, I don't know, a stereotype or somebody fulfilling a certain role. I felt like I understood who he was in the text more, because Nephi's life, and we make this point in the article because we're giving the example of Nephi's life as a series of individual traumas. Nephi's life is punctuated with these horrific stories of violence. In a lot of cases, he's the victim of those violent events. And in a couple cases, he's the perpetrator. He is causing the violence. So just the example that has stood out to me the most is we go from he and his brothers going back to Jerusalem to get the brass plates, and he suffers this severe physical abuse from Laman and Lemuel. Like, the fact that they were beating him with an object, in terms of like conceptualizing that violence in my field, would be this is extremely severe violence. This is life-threatening. And only after it really escalates to that severe level does he get the intervention from an angel. And then he leaves that event and finds Laban passed out, and is told, his telling of the story is that he is told to kill Laban and then go and get the brass plates. And I just, for the first time, saw this is, you can see my field coming out in how I'm talking about it. For the first time, I saw this very sad, wounded youth who went from being very physically victimized to then needing to perpetrate a physical victimization. And how did that event shape the rest of his life? I don't have a clear answer on that, but I cannot imagine what it would feel like to go from nearly being killed to then thinking that you receive a prompting to kill somebody. That just seems like such a life-defining event. And we can kind of see it in how he talks moving forward about the people of Jerusalem, about his brothers Laman and Lemuel, about how he interprets and responds to these other violent events that happen, and how he's teaching his family and the way he's talking about the gospel. I think those are two initial events, and then others compounded on top of it that were really harmful and were really traumatic. And even if Nephi isn't talking about them that way, a trauma-informed lens allows us to, at least for me, it allows me to approach the text with a lot more empathy for the things he's carrying, and to not just take the declarations he's making at face value, but to understand how those are informed by those violent experiences.
It's such a great way of approaching the text, because Nephi, and I feel like in recent years of interpretation, has often gotten a bad rap here as, a little egocentric and you know, self-justification. And so you help us to sort of understand some of those character traits there in a really fresh light. So thank you for that. Moving beyond just individuals, though, you're also talking about like broader groups in the Book of Mormon as well. So where are some examples that we see communal trauma in the text, and how can we kind of approach the text differently with that lens?
Yeah, so this was possibly the most interesting part to me, was tracking the communal trauma that we see, really through the whole book, but we focused on the wars. And communal trauma, we define in the article as slightly different from individual trauma. You're looking at macro events that affect an entire community. And one of the really important things to understand is that communal trauma is not a collection of traumatized individuals. Trauma that affects an entire community, such as a pandemic, a war, a natural disaster, these things tear at the fabric of society itself. So it's not just siloed off people who are hurting. It's looking at how the organism as a whole has been damaged by the event. And those things are very, the communal trauma is very hard to repair, because you're trying to repair it with individuals who have experienced, you know, individual trauma. So one of the things we talk about is broken-spiritedness. And we give the example in modern times of so sociologist Kai Erickson describes an example of broken-spiritedness in the case of Grassy Narrows, which involved the dumping of 20,000 pounds of mercury into the Lake of Woods region in Ontario. And the Ojibwa First Nations people who lived there were absolutely decimated by this. They had terrible health or outcomes, and their main source of income, which was fishing, was completely destroyed. And in the years following, in 1970, when it was discovered, you had a huge number of people who became disaffected from the tribe and left, converted to Christianity, and left the region. And he talks about how basically people's sense of faith, of community identity, is ripped apart by this terrible event. So if you then look at some of the battles in the Book of Alma, there are sections in Alma 45, 21 to 24, and Alma 62, 44, where it talks about huge battles where countless people die. You know, they stop trying to count them and they just say, you know, they throw the bodies in the river and you can like walk over the river. There's so many dead people. And it says that because of their wars with the Lamanites and the many little dissensions and disturbances which had been among the people, it became expedient that the word of God should be declared among them, yea, and that a regulation should be made throughout the church. So that word because indicates that these wars are taking toll on the religious life of the people, that because they have experienced this death, they have these soldiers returning from this, you know, bloody business and then entering back into the society, that people are disaffecting from the church, and therefore Alma has to go out and set a new regulation. So that's just one example. We lay out, you know, a few others concerning identity and the inability to hold on to peace. But I think what you see is the text telling us that violence and faith are deeply interrelated. And that perhaps, I mean, my take on this is that I think this is one of the important reasons for why all of this violence is included in Scripture, because God is telling us violence is not only a physical concern. It's also a spiritual concern and a community concern.
You connect another category here of survival literature to this approach. Can you talk a little bit about what survival literature is and how you see parts of the Book of Mormon fitting into that category?
Yeah, Margaret, you take this one.
Okay. So survival literature, it's a category of literature that is produced in the aftermath of a catastrophe. And one of the signature markers of survival literature is that it is struggling to describe the indescribable. So trauma is inherently not something that people can put into words. And it is actually the work of narrating it into a larger life story and putting that experience into words that is the primary way that in our culture we process trauma and we heal from it. So survival literature can be hard to understand or even identify because the people are at a loss of words for what to say about it. So there's this kind of important paradox in it, because there is an unknowability about trauma, even as people are trying to put it into words. So we identified a couple of places that we see people trying to talk about trauma, even if they cannot directly articulate it. So these are just, you know, some of the places that we pointed out. So for instance, Jacob, at the end of his book, says, "I conclude this record declaring that I have written according to the best of my knowledge by saying that the time passed away with us, and also our lives passed away like as it were unto us a dream, we being a lonesome and a solemn people, wanderers cast out from Jerusalem, born in tribulation, in a wilderness, and hated of our brethren, which caused wars and contentions, wherefore we did mourn out our days." That's Jacob 7:26. So you can see him trying to place all of the terrible things that happened to him in his life, being born in the wilderness, being hated by his brothers, experiencing all of these wars. And what he does is say, use this sort of metaphorical language, our lives passed away like it were, it was a dream. What is he trying to say there? He's saying, I mean, to us, he's saying he can't even put into words how the grief that he's experiencing and that there are things in his memory that are still not quite put into the narrative, not quite healed from, not quite something that he can articulate.
Yeah, there seems to be almost a disassociation that he's experiencing in those moments there. So yeah. One of the things that's so interesting about this is, of course, you know, how we can better understand some of the characters in the text and maybe some of the episodes, the moments, and some of the you know, the ways that they're describing it, the way that they're describing their experiences sort of through these experiences. But it seems to me that one of the other things that your article is suggesting is that this has more than just kind of a scholarly payoff, but that there are some real ministerial, theological, even therapeutic benefits here. Can you talk a little bit about how we might better teach and talk about and read the Book of Mormon from a kind of more ministerial perspective in this light?
Yeah, I can start there. Margaret can add on. So this is, Margaret really enjoyed talking about the communal trauma, and I think it's such an interesting place to dig into. This is the section of the article that I got the most fired up about. I think because I see the implications directly in the work I do day to day. And that is this idea that I think it is a valid and very interesting scholarly framework to approach the Book of Mormon, to approach any text with this trauma-informed lens. But that if we stop there, if that is just like, look, we're going to read it with this lens, look at these interesting questions that we come up with or these new ways of thinking about it. If that's where we stop, I think we really sell ourselves short. And in fact, I don't actually think we fully apply the trauma-informed lens. I think the lens inherently tells us you have to go farther than this. And what that meant for us in this article, what really came out as we grappled with this was we, as a reader, we need to consider the trauma that we carry as well. If I am somebody who has experienced a certain type of harm, if we can go back to the Nephi example, if I have experienced physical abuse from a family member or specifically a sibling, I am going to read that section of text about them beating him with a rod in a very different way than somebody who hasn't experienced that. And I will probably read it differently if I have worked through and tried to heal from that trauma versus if it's still kind of festering and really raw. All of those, you know, various life experiences or various ways of carrying trauma or having trauma are going to affect how an individual relates to the text, understands the text, how they find God in the text. Like, does it bring them closer to God because they feel like they've shared this experience? And thus they can find God in their experiences as well? Or does it push them further away potentially because, well, I didn't get an angel, they may say, or, you know, my harm looked this way and I didn't see God in those spaces. So I think if we are just be like, hey, here is a great scholarly lens and not acknowledging that we have to think about what we're carrying, we don't actually get as close to the text or we're not applying that lens as much as we think we are, or as we should. And then to add to that, we made the point of saying, the way I thought about it is essentially, if you're going to do a trauma-informed reading of the Book of Mormon, you have to think of three loci. You have to think about the trauma that's in the text from the speaker, from the group, from the editor. You have to think about the trauma that you as a reader are carrying. And then because we do, speaking of the ministerial elements, because we do so much public teaching in our meeting houses, whether that's in a talk over the pulpit or just in a classroom, we are often talking about these stories and talking about how to make sense of these stories. And a trauma-informed lens really requires us to be considerate, be mindful, be really, really sensitive to the diverse trauma that people could be holding in the room. I think this goes back to the story that we opened with. If we are talking about some of these stories in the Book of Mormon and we are not considering that somebody in the room could have had an experience like that, if we are talking about a case where a parent was really violent in the case of Abraham and Isaac, and the adults in the room are downplaying or seeking to justify that, how does that affect somebody who experienced that kind of violence from a parent? What does that tell them about God and how they should approach God or how they should trust and rely on God? Or if we have these stories where in the Book of Mormon, where it's very clear that sexual assault happened, and we know the statistics for sexual assault, we know that 1 in 5 people in a room have likely experienced some form of that violence. How is it affecting them and how is it affecting their spiritual path to have a group of people not be sensitive to that and not try to approach the text with empathy and an understanding for that, but instead seek reasons why this wasn't assault or this is what God wanted or, you know, the various other rationalizations that come up when we talk about sexual violence. So that was the part that I felt was a really important case to make. And I hope sincerely that it's the part that people carry with them weekly when they're thinking about the Book of Mormon and applying this lens, that beyond just considering what Nephi went through or even what you went through as a reader, what else could people be holding in that room? And how does that change how we talk about it? Questions we ask, you know, the various ways that we grapple with the text.
HB, Margaret. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I just wanted to add to that. This isn't sort of us just coming up with this idea. Again, turning to biblical studies, this has been well-worn path of using particularly the Old Testament in these ways. And these scholars, theologians, ministers, finding that it turns scripture into an incredibly effective form of healing and comfort for survivors.
Thank you both for talking with us about this today. And it's just such a pleasure to learn more about the research and the passion that you both bring to this project. We hope that our listeners have enjoyed the conversation and have learned something new. If you'd like to learn more, check out Margaret Olsen Hemming and H.B. Franchino Olsen. They have Received Many Wounds, Applying a Trauma-Informed Lens to the Book of Mormon in the summer 2024 issue of Dialogue, and explore other resources on this topic there as well. To our listeners, thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with your friends and colleagues. And don't forget to leave us a review or get in touch with any comments or questions. We hope that you'll tune in for future episodes of our podcast. Please subscribe and rate the show, and be sure to check out the whole range of shows in the Dialogue Podcast Network. Thanks.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.